This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And you know, you can listen to The Takeaway anytime by subscribing to our podcast. You can find that on our website, thetakeaway.org, or on iTunes. Gotta say, it looked like a chilly summer day in Moscow. Yep, the Obama magic seemed to run out there in Moscow. If the honeymoon is over, what does this couple look like in the long term? Resetting Obama's charisma and the U.S.-Russian relationship on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Magic free zone, I guess. I'm John Hockenberry on this Wednesday, July 8th, here with co-host Todd Zwillick. Good morning, Todd. Good
morning, John.
A little tough for Barack Obama there in Moscow, yeah. I thought. We've got to look at the Michael Jackson Memorial Ceremony in Los Angeles yesterday, also on the program. Some sobering statistics about jobs programs and mental health. And unrest in China disrupts a summit in Italy. But first, on the line with us is former Deputy Secretary of State in the Clinton administration and President of the Brookings Institution, Strobe Talbot. Good morning, Strobe.
Good morning, John. Nice to talk to you.
You know, it seems that yesterday's somewhat chilly meetings between the Obamas and the Russians, and you can characterize it however you like, amounted to a double reset, both of Obama's hype globally and the U.S.-Russian relationship. On the whole, are we on a new footing on both of these?
It was better than a nudge and a lot less than a breakthrough and about as good as could be expected, I think.
That assessment. More on the U.S. and Russia in just a moment. Strobe Talbot will stay with us. But first, a rundown of what you need to know this morning in the headlines. The president is in Italy for the G8 summit today, where world leaders will debate whether to push for more stimulus cash going into the global economy. Meanwhile, China's president, Hu Jintao, left that summit to go home to deal with ethnic violence in the country's northwest Xinjiang province. The Communist Party boss in the provincial capital warns that anyone involved in the killings there could face the death penalty. It's unrest between Uyghurs and Han Chinese in that province. Todd?
John, there are more details of the cyber attack that hit U.S. government websites over the holiday. Government officials said it knocked out websites at the Treasury Department, at the Secret Service, and at other offices, and some were still experiencing those problems yesterday. There was a similar attack in South Korea, according to government agents there. Texas farmers are struggling with a drought, the likes of which have not been seen since 1885. Farmers could lose billions of dollars in crops and livestock. Federal bankruptcy judge has denied motions by groups seeking to block sales of GM's assets. The deal's expected to go through by the end of the week. That was a quick bankruptcy. Government investigators were able to smuggle bomb-making materials, meanwhile, into 10 federal buildings. And once inside, they assembled explosive devices and carried them around, according to a new report that'll all come out at a Senate Homeland Security Committee
really
at hearings today on Capitol Hill, John.
In Latin America, talks to resolve the political crisis in Honduras are coming. Both the exiled president and the installed leader have agreed to talks led by Costa Rica. Markets were down about 2% yesterday, and it looks like a flat opening when Wall Street opens in about an hour and a half. The Dow fell yesterday to 8,163, lowest for the blue chip since April 28th. The S&P opens at 881, and NASDAQ starts trading at 1746. We're talking today about health care reform. Vice President Biden is expected to announce that hospitals will give up some many billions of dollars over the next 10 years to help care for the uninsured. Well, if you're uninsured, how have you paid for health care? We want to ask you what solutions you've come up with. Have you foregone medical treatment because of cost? What institutions have provided care to you without insurance? Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry here with Todd Zwillick. And President Barack Obama is off in Italy now at the G8 summit, where there are other issues to deal with. But yesterday in Russia, the president stood before an audience of economic students and wanted his message to be absolutely unmistakable.
Let me be clear. America wants a strong, peaceful, and prosperous Russia. This belief is rooted in our respect for the Russian people and a shared history between our nations that goes beyond competition.
In fact, You could call the shared history between the United States and Russia more of a rivalry. What is the state of that relationship now after this very important meeting between President Barack Obama and the President of Russia and the Prime Minister of Russia, Vladimir Putin, Medvedev, of course, the president? Continuing now our discussion with Strobe Talbot, who's the president of the Brookings Institution, former deputy secretary of state in the Clinton administration, and author of most recently The Great Experiment, The Story of Ancient Empires, Modern States, and the Quest for a Global Nation. Strobe Talbot, you wrote a little bit about this whole idea of resetting the U.S.-Russian relationship, which was ostensibly the mission of the Obama administration. First of all, we talked a little bit about that at the top of the hour. Do you think a reset is a relevant, useful term here?
I think a lot of people are getting kind of tired of it.
Yeah.
And also, it needs to be understood correctly. Resetting a relationship is a little bit like dancing the tango. It takes two to do it. And even the headlines in our own press keep talking about this as though it's up to the United States all by itself to get things right with Russia. And there's an implication there, of course, that we all by ourselves, the U.S., got it wrong. That couldn't be further from the truth. The Russians have a lot of resetting of their own to do. It's going to take a long time to do it. It's going to be a slogging operation diplomatically, but it took a step forward this week, I think.
Although it seems to me that unlike some of the other receptions that Barack Obama has received around the world, he's not coming to two leaders who have any interest in projecting a lot of change, projecting a lot of liberalization. I mean, these are very tough, hardline Russian leaders who have an explicit agenda, and it involves territory in the Caucasus and their relationship with difficult problems in Chechnya, and they've signaled well before Barack Obama arrived that they're not moving on any of these issues.
Well, all true up to a point, John. I'll just make two points on that. First of all, I think there is still a case to be made, although it's long from proven, that there are potentially some differences between President Medvedev and Prime Minister Putin, and we can go into that if you want. But there's no question, as you suggest, that they're joined at the hip to some extent, and they're joined in a pretty tough posture. President Obama needs to be very careful, in fact, more careful than he was at the on the eve of this trip, not to appear to be trying to play the two off against each other, because that won't do Medvedev any good if he is any better than Putin over the long run. The real point here, and I think we ought to maybe just spend a second on this,
sure,
is that on the vitally important question of nuclear arms control, and there's sort of a back-to-the-future quality about that whole subject because we went through the Cold War doing arms control with the Soviet Union, that enterprise is back on track now. And that matters. And I think the hope is, and I think I'd even make a prediction, that some progress between now and the end of the year on strategic nuclear arms control will begin to move the relationship as a whole in a somewhat more positive direction.
So the strategy here is to talk about something that we agree on or can agree on, the U.S. and Russia, and then make progress in a variety of other areas. And you've described them in some of your writing, that if we talk about everything from the Organization of Cooperation, Economic Cooperation in Europe, where Russia is an observer, you can also talk about other economic bilateral and multilateral organizations that Russia has been sort of quiet and now needs to be brought more into. There are a number of channels where this relationship can really be improved.
Right. And even on the really tough issues, and that means Iran and getting the United States and Russia more together in the Security Council to use sanctions if Iran remains on a belligerent course, which there's every reason to expect it will, that too ought to be an area where the Russians will see their interests to be pretty closely in line with the United States. The United States is, they're closer to Iran than we are.
Right.
They've got a large culturally Islamic population. They don't want to see, or shouldn't want to see, Iran become a nuclear weapon state. But again, there is this deep, deep resentment, which you alluded to at the top of the conversation that we're having, of kind of festering resentment about the United States. The Russians have a real case of the kind of Rodney Dangerfield syndrome. They just feel they don't get enough respect, and they're going to stomp their feet and get more. That's kind of their tactic.
Well, Strobe Talbott, president of the Brookings Institution, former deputy secretary of state in the Clinton administration, we're talking about the potential change or sort of repositioning of the U.S.-Russian relationship. You mentioned Iran in a moment ago, Strobe Talbott. Listen to Barack Obama speaking about this issue of using a cooperative relationship to deliver clout in East Asia or the Middle East.
As we keep our own commitments, we must hold other nations accountable for theirs. Whether America or Russia, neither of us would benefit from a nuclear arms race in East Asia or the Middle East.
Now, Strobe Talbott, you have described Russia as being kind of encircled, both geographically and diplomatically at this point in history. Does Russia actually have legitimate clout with governments like North Korea or Iran on this issue of an arms race?
Some. The Chinese have more with regard to North Korea, but the Russians have, I think, very stupidly and short-sightedly given a lot of help to the Iranians, both in their nuclear program, ostensibly their peaceful nuclear program, but we all know it's not really peaceful, and in their ballistic missile program. But just one point on encirclement.
Sure.
That's their perception, or the perception of too many Russians. The flip side of that, the mirror image, I think the more accurate way to say it, is that they are being given a chance to kind of be part of the international community. It's really more of an opportunity for them to join international institutions and that kind of thing. And so they have to, over time, get over this historically very deep-rooted feeling they have that everybody's out to get them. And one of the problems with that attitude, which goes back to Tsarist times, is that when the Russians feel on the defensive, they tend to go on the offensive, as we saw in Georgia. And
right.
Breaking that mindset is a challenge above all for them.
Hi, Strobe Talbott, Todd Zwillich here, and I want to ask, you know, you say the Russians have a long and chronic and deep-seated sense of not getting enough respect, and just in the acute sense, since we have a new president, do you think that they see any movement on the U.S. side in the transition from the Bush administration to the Obama administration, a different attitude that makes a difference to them, or is it the same old song and dance from the United States for them?
Todd, of course, you know, there are different Russians with different perceptions. My guess is that the people who really count recognize more than they're letting on publicly that, of course, there's a difference that is potentially useful to both sides in the transition from George W. Bush to Barack Obama, not least because President Bush really didn't care that much, didn't care at all about treaty-based arms control. He was much more of a unilateralist. That means, you know, the U.S. does what it wants and the rest of the world
right.
can get used to it. And President Obama is committed to diplomacy, committed to treaty-based arms control of a kind that the Russians are used to. They've gotten pretty good at, but they don't want to, you know, feign Obama mania and say, "Oh, this is terrific. Everything is now great because Obama's in the White House," because they think that would lead the United States to make excessive demands on them. So they're just playing it real cool.
And what about on the issue of missile defense, which was a major spur in under their saddle there that George W. Bush instituted unilaterally, like you said. President Obama has decided to review missile defense, not saying whether we would continue with it or discontinue it. Do you think the Russians find any solace there?
I do. I think they do. And by the way, it goes beyond the issue of the anti-missile systems that are contemplated for Poland and the Czech Republic, which was kind of a dumb idea that President Obama inherited from President Bush, but he didn't want to just give it up for nothing, as it were. They really are, that is, the United States and Russia really are, towards the end of the year, going to move towards significantly lower levels of offensive ballistic missiles and systems. That is going to require both sides to reopen the question of whether there doesn't need to be agreed treaty-based regulation of strategic defenses.
Right.
Because the lower you get on the offensive side, the more you need regulation.
And that's where the whole ABM issue, the old
right,
ABM
right.
issue,
I mean,
comes straight out at us. We just got about 30 seconds, Strobe Talbott, before we go. Is it fair to say that the takeaway here is the big challenge going forward for the Obama administration is dealing with a very defensive Russia?
Yes, and getting them to recognize that they've got some resetting to do, including in terms
right.
of their basic mentality.
Exactly. Strobe Talbott, president of the Brookings Institution, former deputy secretary of state in the Clinton administration, author of The Great Experiment, the story of ancient empires, modern states, and the quest for a global nation. Thank you, Strobe.
Thank you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Coming up in just 10 minutes on The Takeaway, we'll talk to a reporter on the ground in China right in the middle of the ethnic unrest that caused Hu Jintao, the president of China, to cancel his visit to the G8 summit in Italy. Stay with us, Todd.
All right, John. Well, yesterday it was a moment across many platforms. It drew millions on television.
All over the world, people are watching on television and in theaters.
The live video stream slowed the internet to a crawl. Facebook reported 500,000 status updates during it, and some reports said it even drew more than the Obama inauguration. There were nearly 20,000 people watching at the Staples Center and thousands more outside the perimeter, all just to say farewell to Michael Jackson.
Dude, we love him. We miss him. And
we'll always miss him.
We'll always miss him. We'll always love him, dude, like, till the end. And even though he's gone, he lives in each and every one of our hearts. And, dude, we'll try to represent him in every way that we can. So we love you, Michael.
Dude, in the end, what we all got to witness.
Sounds like Kobe Bryant there.
However, what we all got to witness, however we watched it, was a farewell fit for a king. And in addition to that, like so much of Michael Jackson's career, a moment that will be defined through images on television.
Very true.
So for a review of the performance and how it looked on TV and what the television images will probably mean for decades to come, Alessandra Stanley, New York Times TV critic. Alessandra, how are you this morning?
Fine. How are you?
I'm very well. What did you make of the television event of Michael Jackson's memorial? Some said too big and gaudy. Some said too small, given his stature.
I think the reason we're still fascinated this morning is that there was an element of surprise, because we didn't know what to expect. And I think if you remember Princess Diana, what was surprising was that the British could be so mawkish and sentimental. We didn't expect it. And so that funeral took on a kind of, how could this happen? In this case, we weren't sure if the Jacksons could actually pull off something that was dignified and appropriate. And the fact that they did gave it an extra kick, if you know what I mean.
The music didn't surprise me. There were performers you would expect, guitarists and singers like Usher and Mariah Carey, to come out to honor Michael Jackson. Brooke Shields wasn't a surprise. I was surprised.
I was shocked by her.
You
I was shocked.
You
I
were
mean,
shocked
I,
by Brooke Shields?
I went, oh, right, Brooke. I mean, I remembered, but it was a shock.
But one thing that did surprise me was that some of this took on a political dimension. I want to play you a cut from Al Sharpton, who gave a stirring speech. Let's listen to something that Al Sharpton had to say.
I want his three children to know, wasn't nothing strange about your daddy. It was strange what your daddy had to deal with.
Alessandra Stanley, not the political dimension there, but Al Sharpton talking directly to Michael Jackson's kids.
I think that is, I have to say, as much Al Sharpton, who gives the best funeral speech of anyone in the world.
He does, doesn't he?
He was speaking to the children, he was speaking to anyone and to the media, which was, it was a perfect moment to sort of recapture Michael Jackson's reputation and say, hey, it wasn't him, it was them. The fact that he addressed the children made it all the more of a kind of memorable moment.
Without disrespecting the memory of Michael Jackson, wasn't that a bit of a weird moment to hear Al Sharpton on the podium saying there was nothing weird about your daddy?
If I was at a funeral and I was 11 years old and I heard that, I would go, man, my dad must have been pretty strange if he brings
well,
this up
I
here.
Well, I think by the time you've been hung from a balcony in Germany, I think you've gotten used to that notion. So I don't think there'd be anything quite that surprising.
Yeah.
But I take your point.
All right, Alessandra Levy from The Times. While we're on it, let's go back to the political dimension real quick. And while we're on Al Sharpton, let's listen to this cut from him, because I want you to react to this too.
He created a comfort level where people that felt they were separate became interconnected with his music. And it was that comfort level that kids from Japan and Ghana and France and Iowa and Pennsylvania, those young kids grew up from being teenage, comfortable fans of Michael to being 40 years old and being comfortable to vote for a person of color to be the president of the United States of America.
All right, Alessandra Lee, Al Sharpton taking it from a pop musician to a cultural and political bridge builder.
Well, I think he's overstating the political appeal of him internationally. I think kids in Japan or Afghanistan or ever loved his music, but I don't think they saw him as, oh, a black kid from Indiana who made good. I think they saw him as what he was, which is an unbelievably talented musician. But I see the temptation of, because I think for Americans especially, you know, his trajectory was an inspiring one for kids.
This next thing I'm going to play for you really struck me as just a quintessential TV moment. Listen to this from Michael Jackson's daughter.
Ever since I was born, Daddy has been the best father you could ever imagine. And I just wanted to say I love him so much.
It, for me, it was the most moving part of the entire thing. And it reminded me of little John Kennedy saluting his father in 1963.
Well, I'm going to be a little bit contrarian. I thought the child was heartbreaking. It made me question once again the Jackson family. You know, this is, you know, the putting children up front and center is what got them into trouble in the first place. And Michael Jackson spent his life as an adult, as a parent, keeping these kids away from the public stage. So, you know, you can see it both ways. It was an, you know, the adorable child touching moment, and probably something her father would not have wanted.
Alessandra Stanley is a television critic for our partners, the New York Times. Thanks for being on The Takeaway. And now I want to give Michael Jackson the last word.
You can't get out. Whew. Oh, the game.
Mark Garrison now is here with the headlines.
Thank you, Todd. 28 minutes after the hour, President Obama is meeting with world leaders at the G8 summit in Italy right now. The leaders are discussing the global economy, climate change, and more. The president meets with Pope Benedict at the Vatican later this week. In China, security forces are out in force trying to calm ethnic tension between Han Chinese and Uyghurs in the country's northwest. Chinese authorities say more than 150 people are dead in the recent violence. A local Communist Party boss says those found guilty of killings will be executed. Leaders of opposing sides in the Honduran political standoff have agreed to a mediator. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says the president of Costa Rica will play that role.
We hope at the end of this mediation there will be a return of democratic constitutional order that is agreed to by all concerned.
The U.S. has called for the return of exiled leader Manuel Zelaya. Back in the States, the government investigators smuggled bomb-making materials into several federal buildings. The Government Accountability Office found security gaps during a probe of building security. The Senate is holding a hearing on the new report today. Back in the U.S., or we're staying in the U.S., rather, a bankruptcy judge is blocking attempts to delay the sale of General Motors assets. People with claims against the automaker want to halt the company's plans, but the judge says GM's restructuring needs to move forward. Drivers are spending less time stuck in traffic. A Texas Transportation Institute study says nationwide rush hour traffic congestion is down. Researchers say higher gas prices and the faltering economy are a big part of that trend. John and Todd.
Thank you, Mark.
Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. The violence in Xinjiang province in northwest China is being called the worst ethnic unrest in that region since the Cultural Revolution, which was three decades ago. The continuing conflict is what Chinese President Hu Jintao used as a reason for leaving the G8 summit this morning in Italy. His departure from the international event underlined the severity of the challenge which the violence in Xinjiang presents to China's leadership and the communist boss of Urumqi, which is the capital city in that region. Xinjiang says the government will seek the death penalty for anyone found to be behind the deaths and the riots in the capital of Xinjiang, 156 people estimated to be killed. We spoke with Yuan Wu and Ted Plafker earlier this morning. Yuan Wu is the editor for the BBC's Mandarin service. Ted Plafker is a correspondent for The Economist who joined us from Urumqi, the provincial capital of the Uyghur region. And yesterday we saw a certain amount of vigilantism, Ted, that the Chinese authorities attempted to control. In our interview, I asked Ted what he thought was going on the streets today.
Earlier in the day today, it was almost as bad as yesterday. Crowds of angry Chinese looking for Uyghurs, shouting slogans saying they wanted vengeance, large numbers of the security forces trying to keep the two groups apart, and clashes in the street with Chinese groups trying to break through police lines, trying to get at some Uyghurs. I saw cases where Chinese crowds assaulted police to make them release Chinese troublemakers that they had tried to arrest.
Now, Ted Plafker, you're the economist correspondent in Beijing, but you're operating in Xinjiang province. How difficult is it for you to operate there? Certainly when there's unrest in Tibet, it's almost impossible to get anywhere near where the actual story is. What's it like working in Xinjiang?
Well, anywhere in China, when something like this happens, authorities very often close the place down. That hasn't happened here. They have allowed correspondents to come here and operate. There are some difficult scenes on the streets, a lot of violent, uncontrollable, unpredictable scenes. And there's also actually a lot of hostility among a lot of Chinese people toward Western journalists. They feel that Western media distorts the picture, blames China for things that it doesn't deserve, constrains China from handling the Uyghur situation the way they think China should. So there have been some dicey moments, and journalists, including myself, have had ugly confrontations with people who just don't seem to think we ought to be here trying to cover this.
All right,
the huge complication is the lack of internet throughout the whole province.
I was just going to ask you, so there's no internet in the province. That must be an enormous handicap. Ted Plafker, the Economist correspondent in Beijing, hold on there. Yuan Wu is the BBC editor of the Mandarin service on the line from London. Bush House, our partner, is the BBC. Yuan Wu, first of all, how difficult is it to put together all of the stories that are coming out of the province, given that the internet service is so spotty?
Well, we, of course, look at what's coming out from China in the official channel, you know, CCTV and the Chinese Xinhua, what they're reporting. And then we set up a forum on Monday to get the viewers, give us their views, or if they were there, what they have seen. And the English website is doing the same. So we are exchanging information on that front. And, you know, and we also get phone calls from the people outside China, you know, belonging to the various Uyghur groups. So putting that together, we can get a fairly good picture of what's going on.
Tell our listeners, Yuan Wu, and you're editor of the Mandarin service at the BBC, and I suspect your listeners are really interested in your assessment of this, but for our listeners, Hu Jintao has really prided himself on a sense of delivering security to the Chinese people, whether it's an earthquake, the anniversary of Tiananmen Square, the unrest there, or this particular situation and also the situation in Tibet. What does it say that he leaves the G8 summit in Italy? Is it a message for his own people, or is it a sign that things are really unraveling?
It could be both. I mean, you know, the fact that he's cutting short of this very important summit to return to China, it shows how seriously the Chinese government takes the present situation. And, you know, after all, China is only an invited guest in the G8, but at home, what's happening is quite pressing. So it shows how seriously and how urgent the situation is.
And the G8's main focus this time around is climate change, and China maybe doesn't want to talk about that. So given the choice between talking about climate change and coming back to deal with the Uyghurs, it's probably a no-brainer for Hu Jintao.
I wouldn't say Hu Jintao was trying to escape any discussion. I mean, China has been quite open about its stance on climate change. But just on the Xinjiang unrest, rest, I think in the past few days, the top leadership haven't said anything. I think they left it to the local, the autonomous region leadership to deal with the situation. So the party boss and the governor there have been making speeches to update the people on the present situation. But they stick to this line, meaning this is, you know, this trouble was stirred up from abroad by this anti-China, anti-ethnic group harmony kind of group called the World Uyghur Congress. And the figurehead of that organization is a woman called Rabia Kadir. And, you know, today Xinhua published a very long article on this woman, how she managed to organize this this whole thing.
All right. Yuen Wu, thank you very much. BBC's editor of the Mandarin Service. She spoke with us from London. Finally, Ted Plafker from The Economist, a correspondent in Beijing. Given the charge of the Chinese saying that it's foreign intervention that's stirring up this trouble and a sense that maybe the shrinkage or the slowing of the Chinese economy being a part of it, which would you say is the larger culprit here?
I'm not sure either one. I think the underlying cause is longstanding ethnic tension. There are serious issues here in terms of how the minority relates to the majority. The economic trouble certainly adds extra tension. And the issue of foreign intervention, that just depends on how you define intervention. A lot of information does come in from foreign sources, and the Chinese consider that to be interference. All right. I don't always distinguish between accurate information and otherwise.
Speaking to Ted Plafker, correspondent for The Economist, he joined us from Urumqi, the capital of the Uyghur region in northwest China, and Yuen Wu, editor for the BBC's Mandarin service. We spoke with them earlier this morning about the ethnic violence taking place in Xinjiang province. And now Mark Garrison has our headlines.
Thank you, John. 21 minutes before the hour, President Obama is in meetings at the G8 summit in Italy right now. World leaders are talking about climate change and the economy. Later this week, the president makes his first Vatican visit to meet with Pope Benedict. Cybersecurity watchers are monitoring an unusually strong series of online attacks against websites in the U.S. and South Korea. Websites hit in America include the Treasury Department and Secret Service. Banks and government websites are the targets in South Korea. Officials there suspect North Korea or its supporters are involved. Parched areas of Texas have farmers worried. The region is experiencing a drought of a strength not seen since 1885. The triple-digit heat and dry conditions could cost farmers billions of dollars in lost crops and livestock. Afghan authorities say six Afghan police are dead after insurgents attacked police and government buildings in the east. 21 insurgents died as well. And in nearby Pakistan, a suspected U.S. drone hit a Taliban training camp today. At least seven are dead. It's the latest in a series of strikes against the top Taliban leader in Pakistan. John and Todd.
Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Some science this morning on The Takeaway. Scientists in the UK say that for the first time they've created from stem cells human sperm. And now the research could obviously allow infertile men to have children, and it sparks perhaps an ethical debate about reproductive biology. But what about the science here? Joining us now from London to discuss this is Clive Cookson, science editor for the Financial Times. Clive, good morning.
Good morning.
What is the science of transforming a stem cell into an actual fertilizable sperm cell that could be used to create an embryo?
This work was done at Newcastle University in the north of England by Karim Nayernia, who's originally from Iran. He was working in Germany, couldn't work with embryos, so moved to the UK. What he's done is taken human embryonic stem cells and then treated them with various chemicals and nudged them along to become sperm, basically. It's quite a complicated process. You have to separate them, give them various chemical nudges, and you have the most important thing, the real scientific breakthrough, is to achieve what's called meiosis. That's the splitting of the chromosomes, so that you get a sperm and they produce sperm, and they've looked through the microscope and they've seen them wriggling around with heads to fertilize the egg and tails to swim around. But I should emphasize, they haven't actually fertilized any human eggs yet.
Now, does this involve sort of backstepping the embryo process? Because by the time the stem cells are embryos, they've passed the sperm stage. Are you stepping backwards, or are you creating some fundamentally new sort of organism and then adding a head and a tail to it?
No, it is another example of the amazing reprogramming or stepping back that scientists are doing with cells. And it should be possible to do it in soon in an even more amazing way. Instead of starting with an embryonic stem cell, you should be able to start with an adult cell, say a skin cell from an infertile man.
So in theory, you could actually create a sperm not from a stem cell, but from a fully adult, a fully specialized cell. Clive Cookson, science editor for the Financial Times, that's the theory here, right?
That is the theory, but I want to emphasize that a long way away. The next step will be to do this by taking a skin cell, taking it back to a stage called a pluripotent stem cell, and then turn it into sperm. But scientists are doing amazing things in the States as well in reprogramming cells to become all sorts of new cells.
Finally, Clive, they say that this could be, a boon for infertile men to have children, but if you can only make these sperm from embryos, infertile men can't produce embryos to begin with. So how would this help infertile males?
Well, in the beginning, it would be the embryos would be like an anonymous sperm donor for an infertile male. But in the long term, as I say, the idea is you take a cell from the infertile male, so it will help them eventually.
I see. So in this particular case, the sperm that they've created are genetic progeny of the embryo itself?
That's exactly right.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, Clive Cookson, science editor for the Financial Times, talking about a story. Scientists in the UK saying that for the first time, they've used embryonic stem cells to produce human sperm. Thank you, Clive.
Thanks.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer students cash rewards for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it bribery? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We're betting you'll be thinking about health care reform when Vice President Biden announces a series of sacrifices that hospitals are announcing to help pay for the uninsured. What sacrifices have you made? How have you paid for health care? What medical treatments have you foregone because of cost? What institutions may have provided care to you even though you don't have insurance? Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Mark Garrison has some headlines now.
Thank you, John. 12 minutes before the hour, the president is in Italy for the G8 summit right now. World leaders are there debating on ways to fix the global economy, talking among other topics. China's president had to leave that summit today to deal with ethnic violence in the country's northwest. The regional Communist Party boss warns that anyone involved in the killings there could face the death penalty. Cybersecurity watchers are looking at an unusually strong series of online attacks. Several U.S. government websites had trouble in recent days, including the Treasury Department and Secret Service. The U.S. attacks come as South Korean websites are also under threat. Government and banking sites have all been hit. South Korea's government thinks there's a connection to the cyber attacks on American sites. Officials in South Korea suspect North Korea or its supporters are involved. A bankruptcy judge has denied motions by groups seeking to block the sale of General Motors assets. The deal is expected to close by the end of the week. Drivers are spending less time stuck in traffic. A Texas Transportation Institute study says nationwide rush hour traffic congestion is down. They're blaming higher gas prices and the struggling economy for that trend. In Latin America, talks to resolve the political crisis in Honduras are coming. Both the exiled president and the installed leader have agreed to talks led by Costa Rica. Extreme drought is hitting Texas. The region is experiencing a massive dry span, the likes of which not seen since 1885. The triple-digit heat and dry conditions will hit farmers in the pocketbook. They don't get better. A recent drought wiped out $4.1 billion in crops and livestock. John and Todd.
Thank you, Mark. So is there a viable life after, a virtuous, for that matter, life after traveling with a rock and roll band? It's a real question for people if that's what they did in their early days. My next guest, Aaron Cohen, found that he could use his skills as a former drug-addicted rock and roller for the band Jane's Addiction to infiltrate brothels all around the world. Where's the virtue, you say? Well, he used that skill to deal in a very direct way with the modern-day emergence of slavery. Often, Aaron would end up buying the freedom of enslaved girls who couldn't get away, like the case of one girl he helped in Cambodia we're going to hear about, Jaunty. It's a controversial approach to dealing with the problem of human trafficking, and Aaron Cohen has just written a book called Slave Hunter with journalist Christine Buckley. They're both here with us now. Aaron, how did you make the decision to buy actual individuals, and does a choice like that help perpetuate the market for human slaves?
Folks look at this issue, and it is controversial, the idea of contributing to a market. But I saw it from a more of a micro perspective, because there was this child in front of me, and I had to make a choice. What am I going to do for this child? And certainly in the book we get into this. One of the young kids in the book, a girl named Jaunty, I have to make a choice. What am I going to do for this girl? Now, I could do nothing and justify that by the idea that I'm not contributing to a market. But I couldn't come to grips in my own mind how that would help alleviate the macro problem. I thought that if I could go one kid at a time, one child at a time, that micro would add up to macro later. And I like to think that that's what happened.
Well, in terms of Jaunty, right, how much did you pay to free her?
I didn't actually pay to free her. What happened was is I went and I identified her singing karaoke in a brothel. I put pressure on her to sing back to me, and it was uncomfortable.
She was 13 years old, so, mm-hmm. Yeah.
She was very uncomfortable, so I invited her to bring some of the other younger kids to sing for us while we enjoyed a little party. Then I filmed some solicitations on my cell phone, and afterwards, the next day, went with a fantastic pastor from a group called Rafa House in Cambodia named Dear Sorum. And Pastor Sorum returned back with the chief of police of the city where they were from.
Let me just get it clearly. I mean, Jaunty's story resulted in how many young girls being freed?
Well, from finding Jaunty, we were able to get 11 girls under the age of 16 out that following morning.
Right. Christine, what attracted you to Aaron's story? And, this is someone with a lot of motives and some of them personal, some of them very, very altruistic. And
I think we have a tendency to look at problems like this, like slavery, like genocide, and say, well, you know, it's complex, it's complicated. And that's a way for a lot of us to just walk away and just, as journalists, even maybe present the information and say, well, this is going on, but, you know, it's going to take a lot of steps to be able to free slaves. So, well, let's just walk away. We'd have to eradicate hunger and extreme poverty, and then who knows where to begin? Well, Aaron's a guy who said, okay, I see these people, and especially when he started freeing children out of brothels, I know that taking this one girl out of here isn't going to solve the big picture, but it is going to save her life. You know, everyone isn't going to be able to, get on a plane and go to country X and start pulling people out of slavery. That's not what we're saying.
But is that how it works? Is that what you accomplish here?
Well,
this is the story of fundamentally just getting on a plane, going to places where you know this is happening, getting off the plane, checking into a hotel, and finding the people who can help.
He can't do this for the rest of his life either, but what we're trying to say is, let's take responsibility for our role as citizens in perpetuating this. And that's not just sex slavery, which is what we're talking about here. We're also talking about agricultural workers, enslaved domestics.
Christine, as a journalist, we don't want to annoy Aaron here. Can you estimate how many people he's actually set free through some actions of his?
Aaron, would you say, I mean, it's in the thousands. I don't know exactly how many, but, I think numbers are problematic. I don't think we should talk about numbers because, you know, free is, you know, as you said, someone like John T, who we mentioned earlier, Aaron brought her out of the brothel into a shelter, and then she later died, you know, from complications related to the drugs that she was forced to take for her whole life. So I don't think we should talk about numbers. I think we should talk about, we can. There are 27 million people estimated to be enslaved in this world.
Aaron, you've gone into some very dangerous places and dealt with some pretty ruthless people. Have you ever thought that, you know, maybe you have something of a death wish on your own? I mean, this story is really about that, it seems.
You know, the party credentials that I developed from working with Perry Farrell and Jane's Addiction gave me a sense of adventure in certain circumstances other people don't have. And I'm not shocked. You know, it's Perry's classic phrase, nothing's shocking. I'm not shocked by some of these tragic things you see in brothels because, after all, I was with the Jane's Addiction Circus for so many years. So ultimately, I think that...
It's good prep for ending slavery.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't have this idea that we were going to end slavery. I just took it like, okay, I'm just one guy in a chain of people trying to make things happen, and that's how it worked. It wasn't like one person going on an airplane and freeing slaves. It was an entire infrastructure of people, a band raising money, activists on the ground, care providers.
I understand. I mean, I'm not trying to give you the Nobel Prize. You know, I know how deeply that would offend you, but seriously, you have made some choices here that are – really amazing to behold. How challenging was it to collaborate on this book, Christine?
I think it was really challenging because, I mean, Aaron is a complex individual. I mean, I think, and there's a lot of people along the way who maybe doubted his motives. And
you among them?
Maybe in the very beginning when I first met him, I said, this is crazy. Who is this guy? I mean, why are do you have a death wish? Are you a danger addict? Have you replaced your addiction to drugs to an addiction to danger? I mean, this is crazy. But in coming to know him, I mean, and I think that's why I sort of put my life on hold for 2 years and have now become, you know, an anti-slavery activist because...
Mommy slave hunter.
he's joking, but I mean, you know, he really does live this. He really does believe this, and I think we both have come to believe that it is possible to end slavery as we know it, not just sex trafficking, all kinds of slavery in this country and elsewhere, and we could be a model for that. I mean, the country that supposedly wiped out slavery, you know, with the 13th Amendment could actually be the country to wipe it out mm-hmm. for real in 25 years or less.
We take our freedom for granted. And the message for me with this book is don't take your freedom for granted. Do something about your personal freedom and the freedom of others.
Do something indeed. Aaron Cohen, Christine Buckley wrote Slave Hunter, One Man's Quest to Free Victims of Human Trafficking. Thanks to both of you for joining us. A direct approach, micro and macro. Pretty impressive.
All right, we're continuing our conversation about health care this morning and announcements expected by Vice President Biden that hospitals will give up hundreds of $155 billion over the next 10 years for the uninsured. While the country tries to figure out the health care issue, we want to know what solutions have you come up with. If you're uninsured, what fixes have you come up with? Have you foregone medical treatment because of cost? Have you tried some home remedies? Tell us your stories at 8778-MYTAKE or email us mytake@thetakeaway.org. And here's your takeaway.
They don't want to feign Obama mania and say, oh, this is terrific, everything is now great because Obama's in the White House, because they think that would lead the United States to make excessive demands on them. So they're just playing it real cool.
That's Strobe Talbot, president of the Brookings Institution, former deputy secretary of state in the Clinton administration. He joined us this morning to talk about the president's talks with Russia. If you missed anything, we're always online at thetakeaway.org. You can see our coverage of the Michael Jackson Memorial in L.A. yesterday. Here's one fan who was very happy to attend.
His music, his voice, it was able to touch people in a way that I don't think any other entertainer has been able to reach. So I'm just excited to be here and, you know, celebrate his life.
Also attending that memorial, Brooke Shields, Jennifer Hudson, Stevie Wonder.
They didn't call us back, though.
John Hockenberry and Todd Zwillick by television watching exactly. And millions of other people. I am Todd Zwillick.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
And now another episode of a drama close to the hearts of Americans, our national health care debate.
General Hospital is brought to you by Rolaids in Handy Roll, a new family-size bottle. By Clairol, creators of the exciting natural look of beauty. And by the new Playtex Girdle, made with Lycra.
These days, sales of Rolaids shampoo and girdles can't support the cost of hospitals. As policymakers debate health care reform, medical institutions offer $155 billion in potential cost savings. General Hospitals, nothing about Port Charles and the Quartermains, I assure you. It's heartburn over health care on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, July 8th. I'm John Hockenberry. More about the economics of healthcare in just a second, but also on the program, unrest in China disrupts a summit in Italy, the ethics and morality of leftovers. That's right. There's an enormous ethical question every time you open your refrigerators. But first, Dr. Herbert Pardes, you are the CEO of one of the biggest hospitals in the United States, New York Presbyterian. I've got to ask you, so if hospitals like yours can find $155, $151 billion in cost savings that are going to be announced today at the White House, why couldn't we have seen these discounts and have helped the uninsured years ago?
Well, I think that it took a concerted and coordinated action, which you're seeing today, by people in government, providers, various constituencies working together. And I think that's one of the positive stories today.
Well, we're going to look at how coordinated and concerted this announcement from the Obama administration might be later today. Dr. Pardes will stay with us. Lots of tough numbers, though, eh, Todd Zwillick, co-host today? Huh?
A lot of tough numbers, and they're even tougher in Congress, where they're hunting for $1 trillion on healthcare.
Todd's going deep into medical economics in just a moment. But here are some headlines. In the headlines, President Obama has arrived in the quake-ravaged town of L'Aquila for the G8 summit in Italy, and China's president left that summit today to deal with ethnic violence in his country's northwest Xinjiang province. The violence is between the Uyghurs and the Han Chinese. We'll have more about that. New details on the cyber attack that knocked out U.S. government websites over the holiday today. Officials say it hit agencies that deal with national security, including the Secret Service. Some were still having problems as late as yesterday. Todd?
John, farmers in Texas are struggling with a bad drought, the likes of which have not been seen since 1885. Farmers could lose billions of dollars in crops and livestock. A federal bankruptcy judge has denied motions by groups seeking to block the sale of GM's assets. The deal's expected to go through by the end of the week. Meanwhile, government investigators were able to smuggle bomb-making materials into 10 federal buildings. Once inside, they assembled explosive devices and carried them around. That's according to a report that's going to be released by the Senate Homeland Security Committee today, John.
That's terrific. And Latin America talks to resolve the political crisis in Honduras are coming. Both the exiled president and the installed leader have agreed to talks led by Costa Rica. Markets open this hour. Flat opening is expected based on the futures trading. The Dow fell to 8163 yesterday, though. The S&P opens at 881 and the Nasdaq starts at 1746. So if hospitals can make $155 billion worth of sacrifices to help in health care reform, what have you already done if you're one of the uninsured? How have you paid for health care? Have you foregone medical treatment because of cost? Have institutions provided care to you without insurance? Tell us your stories at 877-8MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're all making sacrifices. What are yours?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Health industry groups are expected to deliver.
If you like the plan you have, you can keep it.
To take over the healthcare system, either directly or indirectly, for the government to control it.
A lot of my friends, where they get their healthcare from is the emergency room. They're in the emergency room every week. They break a nail in the emergency room.
How are you going to avoid not having the ability to cost shift as you shrink that portion of privately funded health insurance?
Well, in our continuing discussion on the health reform debate going on all spring and all this summer, hospitals are the latest arm of the healthcare industry to get on board with President Obama's plan to retool the healthcare system, at least in terms of rhetoric. Vice President Joe Biden is expected to announce later this morning that hospitals have agreed to pony up $151 billion over the next 10 years. to care for some of this country's uninsured. Well, we're here now with Dr. Herb Pardes. He's president and CEO of New York Presbyterian Hospital, as we said, one of the largest hospitals and hospital systems in the United States. And we're also joined on the line with by David Herzenhorn, reporter for our partner, The New York Times, who covers the Senate. He's been writing about today's agreement in the paper. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Well, Dr. Pardes, you're here in the studio, and I want to start with you. $151 billion in this announcement from the Vice President and Secretary Kathleen Sebelius later on today. $151 billion? Where's it going to come from?
Well, my impression is that hospitals will have to squeeze quite a bit. They already are being squeezed in states like New York. We've had successive cuts because of problems in state budgets, and that's not unusual around the country. But one of the most important things that's happening in this new health reform effort is the fact that we're trying to spread coverage as widely as possible. And I think that's an important principle, long overdue. And by providing that kind of coverage, hopefully that provides some revenue to the hospitals to take care of some of the reductions that they take, but also means better quality care for people and a place that they can go for their health care, which means that they won't be coming, hopefully, in as many numbers to the emergency room.
So that means when uninsured people come to the emergency room or people who cycle in and out of Medicaid maybe come to the emergency room, hospitals scrap for money from the state and from the federal government. But if everybody's insured, as the president and people in Congress hope they'll achieve, then that's basically a larger revenue pool for you, and you can afford some cuts elsewhere.
Creates a far better climate for the patient, first and foremost. The patients who don't have a doctor, don't have a nurse practitioner, somebody who takes care of them, is often coming into the emergency room too late, more sick, more required costs, and the emergency rooms around the country are just choked.
Now, a lot of people might have read, may not have read, actually, Paul O'Neill's editorial in the New York Times 2 days ago, which struck me. He's saying there's a lot of savings at hospitals by doing some easy things that we've been wanting them to do for years and years. Hygiene, preventing intra-hospital infections, making sure nurses and doctors and orderlies wash their hands many, many, many times a day. It's cheap and could save billions, and it's not being done. You think that's part of this plan? Is that something that Congress can account for in their savings or something you need to do on your own?
We are doing it. Many, many hospitals are working. Hand washing, I think, is critical. Very crucial to infection control. And, for example, at New York Presbyterian, we have some of the highest figures in terms of hand washing throughout the country. We take it very seriously. We have quiet observers who make sure that people are doing it, and we're pleased with it, and we're seeing results in terms of reduced infections. I think Paul O'Neill makes a good point. Whether one can get as far as he says may be a little bit more challenging, but I certainly think we should be pushing as aggressively as we can.
All right, Dr. Herbert Pardes, psychiatrist, CEO of New York Presbyterian Hospital, is in the studio with us, and I want to turn to David Herzenhorn, Senate reporter for The New York Times. He's been writing about the proposed $151 billion in hospital savings in the Times today. David, the hospitals aren't the first major healthcare industry lobbying constituency group to come forward and say they want to pony up money, but that sounds really great to me. What do the details look like in Washington in terms of where you get this money?
They're not the first. The drug companies would be happy to tell you that they were the first.
Right.
You know, Rahm Emanuel, the White House Chief of Staff, says a lot these days. Everybody wants to jump on this train because they realize it's leaving the station. But you know, there are so many ins and outs to this, and obviously one of the key components in the agreement with the hospitals was assuring them that in fact all these other changes that the Obama administration and Congress are promising will actually take hold. And so a lot of this cost savings, Todd, you know the Congress as well as I do, takes place over the course of the full 10 years that the Congressional Budget Office scores legislation. And they actually target some of the savings to kick in later on once they've proven that insurance coverage has expanded more broadly to create that larger pool of patients. But what we don't know is how effective that will be, how many people will end up covered that aren't covered right now, and even if they are covered, do things really start getting more cheaper and more effective, or down the line do you realize you're providing a lot more care to a lot more people at a lot bigger price?
And I got to ask you about the politics of this, David, because this is the second such announcement. Actually, it's the third. We had all of the industry groups holding hands together about a month ago saying they were going to save $2 trillion over 10 years. And then pharma and the drug companies said they would pony up 80. The hospitals say 151. Nobody's seen a penny of it yet because the debate's not over. And the White House trots these out as a growing consensus on health reform. But the debate in Congress where the heavy lifting is being done doesn't seem to be affected too terribly much by these announcements in the debates between individual lawmakers.
Well, it is to some degree, because Max Baucus, for instance, senator from Montana, chairman of the Finance Committee, has been heavily involved in some of these talks. But, of course, one committee, one group of senators is not going to get you a bill passed. And so even as Baucus was a huge player, maybe the central player in helping to bring this hospital agreement about, Chris Dodd, the Democrat from Connecticut who's leading the health committee in the absence of Ted Kennedy, was saying yesterday, look, I want to know what the ask is. What are these groups asking for in exchange for the savings? He says a lot of times, you know, the cost of the ask exceeds whatever savings you're going to get. Then you have a senator like Olympia Snowe, centrist Republican from Maine, who could provide a crucial Republican vote for a health care plan, who said, look, I haven't signed on to any of this. You know, we haven't seen the details. You know, it's one thing for the president to make an agreement. It's another thing for Congress to do that. But what they are doing is certainly lining up folks who could be major obstacles. If America's hospitals come out and say, this is a bad bill, this is a bad idea, you're not going to get the kind of care that you've come to expect in this country.
We've got the institutional players, we've got the Congress, but let me bring the consumers in here for a second, David Hersenhorn of the New York Times. I mean, and I actually want to take from what you were saying, which actually disturbed me a little bit, and put it to Herbert Pardes here in the studio from New York Presbyterian Hospital. It sounds as though, on the one hand, this offer of $155 billion or $151 billion, whatever it is either an offer of services to the uninsured over some period of time, or it's more of a threat that if we don't get some insurance plan, we're actually not going to deliver this $155 billion of cost savings. Both of those are kind of disturbing to me as a consumer, because on the one hand, if it is an open-ended offer of services for the uninsured, my costs are going to go up as an insured person. And secondly, if it's a threat, it feels as though it could derail the entire deal.
I think you can characterize things in all kinds of ways. Seems to me what Senator Baucus has done is rather remarkable, and that is he's going to one constituency after the other, asking them to take a shared responsibility in making something very important happen for this country. And I just want to say, I don't give a darn really who came first in doing it. I'd like to see it done. I don't think anybody should be in this country without health care insurance. I think we should be trying to extend that quality to everywhere. And it wasn't born in the hospital minds yesterday. We've been trying to work on this steadily. This doesn't come from nowhere. It's not as if we've not been working to try to reduce infections, reduce errors, reduce length of stay, make surgery non-invasive.
No, I totally understand. But somewhere deep in this sort of everybody holding hands kumbaya moment with Joe Biden today, is there in the fine print a suggestion from the hospitals that if we don't get a reasonable deal here, we're going to start denying services?
I mean, and I want to add to that. David Hersenhorn said senators want to know what's the ask from hospitals. What's the ask?
I'm not interested in denying services. I'm interested in giving services. As a matter of fact, New York Presbyterian does about 20% of all the health care in New York City, and we welcome it. I want to make sure that it gets to everybody, because I think we have a quality product. We want to keep it quality, and we're on board with the idea we should try to keep the dollars as tight as possible.
And in fact, what a lot of hospitals will tell you is that they're providing the coverage now and, in fact, not always getting paid for it. So their hope is that this legislation takes hold and more people are covered by some form of insurance, and therefore there's a guarantee that, you know, there will be paying patients, you know, again, not necessarily overly generous patients, but that between the government and the insurance deals that are reached, you have care that is covered in some way. But look, there's no question that, you know, at the heart of this is a separate other issue, which is, do medical services in the United States get more efficient and more cost-effective? And that's a very separate question.
And not just more volume. That's part of the other question. David Hersenhorn at the New York Times covering health care in the Senate. Dr. Herb Pardes, President and CEO of New York Presbyterian Hospital, talking to us about health reform, $155 billion on the table.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to try to get to the bottom now of some 4th of July server fireworks, and there are some sparks still flying. Computer servers. What is increasingly looking like a coordinated attack against computer systems around the world. Investigators are looking at attacks which affected the websites of the Treasury, the Secret Service, the Federal Trade Commission, and the Transportation Department. Some sites are still experiencing problems as recently as last night. Officials say it was an unusually lengthy and sophisticated operation. And in South Korea, police are also investigating similar sorts of attacks on government websites, which forced them to be shut down for several hours on Tuesday. All of this is timed for the U.S. holiday and events in North Korea. The best reporter on the planet to try to get to the bottom of this is undoubtedly Siobhan Gorman, Wall Street Journal's intelligence correspondent. We welcome her back to The Takeaway. Siobhan, thanks for helping us out here.
Thank you.
Well, let's talk about what is unusual about this attack. They are so-called denial of service attacks, correct, where they shut things down. They don't take control of them like on 24.
Exactly. The reason why I think U.S. officials, initially might not have been quite as worried about these attacks was that it's a fairly common form of attack and it's not that sophisticated. What has now sort of raised concerns is that it seems to be so widespread, it does seem to potentially have some links to these attacks in South Korea, and it's affected many government agencies over the course of multiple days, and so it does seem to be harnessing the power of lots of different sort of unsuspecting computers, perhaps around the planet, to try to attack these various websites.
So interesting. So dumb attacks, but on a scale that is coordinated, and that's what's really disturbing and may mean that this is more of a rehearsal for something more disturbing later on.
Yes, and there's been some debate among cybersecurity specialists about how worried they should be about what's called these botnet attacks, which is when you can create a program that kind of harnesses the power of lots of different computers that really aren't doing much else. Maybe they're online, but they aren't in heavy use, and you can use them to direct these attacks to basically shut down websites. And they tend to have more impact if they're against institutions that interface with the public, like banks, and that's what's happened in South Korea, because it means that then banks are having trouble doing business with the public. In terms of shutting down U.S. websites, the impact on operations seems somewhat minimal, but if you can deface a number of U.S. federal government websites, particularly something like the Secret Service, which is responsible for investigating cyber crimes, then that catches people's attention.
Any insight into the alleged North Korean connection, which some South Korean officials are talking about here?
Well, I think that U.S. officials are looking into it. There's certainly a coincidence in terms of North Korea's recent, sort of activity on the missile and the sort of nuclear testing front. And so there certainly could be a connection there. I don't know that anybody has found anything solid. It's often very hard to pin down blame in terms of cyber attacks because it's very easy to make it look like an attack is coming from some particular location, but it could actually be coming from someplace half a world away. It's just very easy to kind of fake identity in cyberspace. So it may be a little while before they can actually pin down the identity, if they ever can.
Hey, Siobhan Gorman, this is Todd Zwillick here. And I wonder if this really goes beyond nuisance at this point, and if this points up any significant security lapses on the part of our government and our agencies. I mean, if it's just a question of denial of service attacks that shut down websites, with website and internet and IP redundancy, you can sort of get around that, right? So
yeah.
Does this point up any kind of vulnerability that would really be serious in the future for this kind of attack, or is it just annoying?
I think that that's what U.S. officials are trying to determine. I was told in talking with some people this morning that the officials at the Department of Homeland Security who are responsible for protecting, non-military government computer systems have been telling people in internal discussions that they were on this, they were working to mitigate it ahead of time and things like that. However, the person who was describing this to me noted that obviously it didn't work. So I think that may be an element that the government will look at in terms of, well, if we do get warning, are we actually taking adequate action ahead of time to try to stave these things off? Because that does undermine confidence in the ability to actually deal with bigger issues in the future.
Well, Siobhan Gorman, Wall Street Journal intelligence correspondent, one of the reasons we would like to talk to you about these subjects is because, you know, often you're much more, you know, sophisticated on the issue of design here. And it seems like you've raised a design question for systems all over the world, in that the idle computers that are a part of the whole redundant systems that back up systems in times of, you know, high use are part of the vulnerability here. If you have extra servers that are idle, they may be the entry point for these sorts of security attacks.
That's indeed true. And in fact, it's not just servers, it's everybody's individual computer. In fact, Melissa Hathaway, who's sort of currently the lead person on cybersecurity in the White House, gives some very practical advice. She says, if you're not using your computer, turn it off. And the reason why she says that is because if it's turned off, it's not connected to the internet. It's not susceptible to being sort of scooped up in one of these botnet attacks. But I was talking with someone not too long ago who said that he had identified, I think, 75 million internet protocol addresses, so individual machines that had been compromised by botnets recently.
Wow. So oh, that's amazing.
It's pretty widespread.
Yes, and every computer is a window in. Siobhan Gorman, Wall Street Journal intelligence correspondent, talking about the cascade of cyber attacks that have been reported since July 4th. Thank you, Siobhan.
Thank you.
All right, Mark Garrison.
Oh, Mark Garrison has the headlines.
Sure, I'm around.
I'm lost.
No worries. 28 minutes
cyber
after
attack.
The hour. Our cyber systems are fine here at the Takeaway. In any case, President Obama is joining other world leaders at a G8 summit in Italy right now. They're tackling problems including the economy, climate change, and hunger. The Government Accountability Office has found security breaches in several federal buildings. These are none of the cyber variety. Investigators got bomb-making materials past security there. The Senate is holding a hearing on the new report today. Triple-digit temperatures and dry conditions in parts of Texas have farmers worried. It's the driest patch there in about a century. Farmer Jimmy Willeen says he'll probably lose two-thirds of his crop.
Well, it hurts a lot because you have the same inputs, but you get less when you harvest. So it hurts a lot, yeah, especially 2 years in a row.
Ranchers are selling off more cattle to head off losses. A previous drought it cost them in the billions of dollars. Fewer drivers are apparently hitting the road. A Texas Transportation Institute study says nationwide rush hour traffic congestion is down. Researchers say higher gas prices and the faltering economy are behind the trend. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says the president of Costa Rica will mediate the political standoff in Honduras. Ousted leader Manuel Zelaya wants to be reinstated. A military government has refused to let him back in the country so far. In northwest Pakistan, dozens are dead after a series of suspected U.S. drone attacks today. The attacks target the stronghold of the top Taliban leader in Pakistan. John and Todd.
All right. Thanks, Mark. Well, coming up on The Takeaway in just a couple of minutes, we talk to a former EPA official about the G8 summit going on in Europe, where climate change is at the top of the agenda for the first time. So stay with us. This is The Takeaway.
Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. Todd Zwillick here with John Hockenberry. The G8 meeting of world leaders kicks off today in L'Aquila, Italy. And the big news from this morning is that Chinese President Hu Jintao left the meeting to return to his country to deal with ethnic strife between Chinese Uyghurs and the Han Chinese there. His departure leaves behind a big debate on how to deal with climate change. The Chinese are key in this debate, and so are the Indians, for that matter. Neither is a member of the G8, but they're observing anyway. And it's the first time climate change has held such prominence in a meeting of the world's major leaders there. Here to tell us about what climate news we can expect from this week's summit is Jason Burnett. He's a former official at the Environmental Protection Agency, where he was in charge of climate change and energy policy. He's now the founder of Burnett Eco Energy, a company that funds clean energy projects. He joins us now from Carmel, California. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning, Todd. Good morning, John.
Good morning. So Barack Obama walks into the room at the G8 with something that no other president before him has either wanted to have or could get, even if they wanted it, and that's major progress on a climate change bill at home. We're not there yet, but he's got something on the table to show to the EU leaders. Does that help their attitude towards us, do you think, on reaching a final agreement on global carbon levels and temperature?
I think it does. I think it changes the game in the international negotiations. It's very hard for a U.S. president to commit to something internationally and then bring it back to the U.S. Congress and ask them to rubber stamp it. That's just not the way our Congress works. And so instead, we're seeing action first at the domestic level. And I think it's only after we see more domestic action that we'll be able to commit to an aggressive emission reduction goal in the international context.
Okay, now, Jason Burnett, I think you probably know what you're talking about in this regard. You were a EPA official in the Bush administration, and you quit, right, under protest that you couldn't get your climate change work done under the previous administration. Is that right?
That's right. We had developed a response to a Supreme Court case and found that greenhouse gases endanger the public and therefore require regulation. And that's significant because, as I said, we need to have action first domestically before the U.S. will be able to engage in a really substantive way in the international discussion.
Okay, but in the international discussion, of course, the Europeans are worried that the U.S. is off cutting side deals with China. We mentioned that Hu Jintao has left the meeting because he has domestic concerns between Han Chinese and Uyghurs of his own. But the Europeans are upset that we're off cutting side deals with the Chinese on carbon that's going to leave them out of the loop and leave them out of potential major industrial deals. Is that a major hurdle at this meeting?
I don't think so. I think the important point is that the Chinese really are taking action. They may resist the sort of commitments that they want the U.S. and they want Europe to take, but in fact, they are doing a lot domestically themselves. They're investing a huge amount in their equivalent of a stimulus package in green energy, in fact, over twice as much as what the U.S. has invested in clean energy in the stimulus package.
Have they committed to carbon reductions, a number?
They haven't, and for that matter, neither has the U.S. But the point is they are taking concrete actions that are reducing emissions, and the U.S. is taking concrete actions on reducing emissions. Well, and I think that that's what needs to happen first before any of the major economies will commit to something internationally. They need to have demonstrated that they have the ability to actually get something through their domestic political system and begin reducing emissions before they will be willing to commit to those emission reductions in an international context.
But Jason, hang on. It's almost the opposite from the view in Washington, because there are plenty of senators, moderate Democrats especially, who are saying the opposite of what you're saying, which is I'm not voting for major reductions in carbon for something that's going to hamper agriculture or industry in my state until I know that there's an agreement with China or India that they'll reduce carbon. There's no point in the United States doing this unless big polluters in Asia and the subcontinent do it first. So it seems like they're loggerheads.
If we think back to what happened during the Clinton administration in the development of the Kyoto Protocol, we can see why it's important to get the order of domestic action first and then international action. In the development of the Kyoto Protocol, the U.S. helped negotiate that protocol, and then the Clinton administration brought it back home and realized it was dead on arrival. It wasn't even worth submitting to the Senate for ratification because we didn't have the domestic political support for doing it, and the Senate didn't want to be seen as a rubber stamp something that had been agreed internationally.
You've made that point, Jason Burnett, former associate deputy administrator for the EPA. I guess it sounds like the argument you are making, and it seems to be the takeaway from this conversation, is that you don't even support the G8 being a place to resolve this, that you're actually much more comfortable with side deals between the U.S. and China, or a side deal between the U.S. and India, that in fact that's the only way to get this entire process started.
Well, I think the reason that we're more likely to see progress this time is that we now have domestic action in the U.S., we have domestic action in China, we have domestic action in the EU countries. And because we already have that action, countries will be more comfortable signing up for some sort of commitment in the international progress process. It needs to be an iteration where we first take action domestically and then we commit to some of that action internationally, and then maybe we come back and commit to additional domestic action.
Right.
And that's, I think, how we're going to see this play out. We've already taken some action domestically in the U.S. We're likely to take more over the next several years.
And the one country we didn't mention there where there's action is India, and that's going to be key in the United States as they talk about climate legislation into this fall. Jason Burnett, former EPA official in the Bush administration, former climate official, joining us to
and
comment.
Cat owner.
And cat owner, apparently. Yes, I heard that too. Cute cat owner, apparently, is joining us to talk about the G8 meeting and climate curbs they hope to come out of that meeting in L'Aquila, Italy. Now Mark Garrison is here with headlines.
Thank you, Todd. 21 minutes before the hour, we've been talking all morning about President Obama at the G8. A heavyweight guest is no longer at that summit, though. Chinese President Hu Jintao has left to go home and deal with ethnic unrest between Han Chinese and Uyghurs. Chinese security forces have a heavy presence in the area, and it's growing. Chinese officials say more than 150 people have died in the unrest. South Korean officials suspect cyber attacks in the U.S. and South Korea are linked. The attacks on U.S. government websites caused problems in recent days. Banks and government websites have been hit in South Korea as well. Officials there suspect North Korea or its supporters. The North's leader, Kim Jong-il, made a rare public appearance today. He attended an event marking his father's death. Kim Il-sung is still the country's president, even though he died 15 years ago today. His title is Eternal President. In Afghanistan, dozens are dead after hundreds of insurgents attacked police posts in a government building in the country's east. Those are the headlines for now. John, what else do we have going on?
Are you hungry, Mark?
Always.
Are you hungry? What do you think of leftovers?
Leftovers are fine, actually.
Well, here's the
issue. That's a good way to save
money. Here's the issue. You have tons of leftovers. You make a delicious roast one night. But is it okay to fix leftovers for your guests? Are they suitable only for your own consumption? Do they stay in the fridge too long and turn into science projects? We're going to talk with two New York Times food writers about how to make leftovers pretty and moral. That's even more important in about 10 minutes.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And last week we were talking about Google offering free technological services to replace for-pay phone services offered by Vonage and others, including Spinbox, our partner here on this program. Today, Google is announcing that it's launching a challenge directly to Microsoft, planning to launch an operating system for personal computers. It's a direct competition with the software giant Microsoft, which, of course, dominates the market for a software that runs PC applications. Sam Grobart, personal technology editor for The New York Times, joins us. Sam, you're on the line from Queens, New York. I'm catching you at a good moment here.
You're catching me on Northern Boulevard, which is always, you know, one of the more scenic routes in New York City.
And you can use Google Maps to find out exactly where that is if you're one of our listeners outside of the New York area. Is Google offering this for free, and would this operating system be loadable onto any PC, and when will it be available?
The plan is for the operating system to be available sometime next year. It will be an open source platform, which means that various software developers can work with it and tweak it and get right into the code, much like Linux. As of right now, it's not clear what the cost will be, but it's possible that the operating system will, in fact, be free.
It's possible that it will be. Now, if it's free, that's the huge headline here. It basically means Google is sucking the entire sort of computer market into this sort of free domain. And it suddenly gives Google questionable ownership of people's data, right?
Well, certain privacy advocates are very concerned about Google. As you know, they have been for some time. Google continues to add on more and more features and functions that many people find very convenient. However, it does mean that Google is sort of potentially, you know, aware of what's in your email, aware of what's in your documents that you store on Google Docs. Of course, they've never demonstrated that they've done anything, you know,
well,
malicious with
it. I don't want to get bogged down on privacy. It's a huge potential sort of computer digital monopoly.
Well, I mean, you know, right now, I think it's something like, what is it, 80 or 90% of personal computers operate on the Windows platform. So, you know, Google still has a long way to go if they're going to increase market share and replace someone like Microsoft.
Well, let's look at the track record then. When Google offers a product and it is free and it is an alternative to another product that's already available in the market, maybe even a product that's been around for some time, what's the track record on, forget the free for a moment, on the product being better than what it's replacing?
Google has definitely demonstrated an ability to create very interesting, compelling products that people like. But as a point of comparison, John, I would just point out that Linux has been a free or very inexpensive operating system. It has many adherents, but as far as the average consumer is concerned, it hasn't really made that penetration yet. So it's not quite clear exactly what this will mean for the operating system landscape.
And Sam, Todd Zwillick here. If Google does come up with an operating system, what are you envisioning in terms of interoperability with things like GChat, Android phones, all the Google applications that are coming out already? Would this be kind of seamless on your desktop? What might that look like?
It will most likely be seamless. That's sort of a word that every, you know, operating system developer wants to be able to use for their product. Google's OS will operate within the Chrome browser. That's Google's own web browser that released last year.
All right, Sam, we got to go. Any idea on the name of this? You said Chrome, which is the browser. What's the operating system going to be? It's not going to be OS.
No, but it may be Chrome OS. That's what
Chrome
we're understanding
OS.
Is
All
going
right.
to be the name of the OS itself.
Sam Grobart, personal technology editor for the New York Times, talking about Google's operating system to be offered next year. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer students cash rewards for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it bribery? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Coming up, the potential and protocol of mystery meats in your refrigerator. Laughing about leftovers in a moment, right after headlines with Mark Garrison.
Thank you, John. 12 minutes before the hour, and President Obama and other world leaders are just out with a new draft statement from the G8 summit in Italy. The eight countries stress the economy and pledge to do more to nurse it back to health. Back in the U.S., Texas farmers are struggling with a drought, the likes of which not seen in a century. And Pakistani officials say dozens are dead after a series of suspected U.S. drone attacks today in the northwest. John.
But the drought, let's talk about that for a second. It's because the jet stream is moved north, and that's keeping hot weather farther to the south.
Yeah, I mean, the basics are it's hot and it's not raining, and so, you know, they have all the problems like there. So it's crops as well as livestock.
All right. Thank you, Mark. Good morning, everyone. Today in world culture, the thorny issue of what to do with leftovers is opened when you open your refrigerator. But we should remind people that down through history, leftovers have brought us all kinds of dishes, soups, stroganoffs. What to do with leftovers is something that's been going on for quite a long time. But to deal with it in our modern era, here in the 21st century, we've invited Henry Alford, food writer for the New York Times, and our dear friend here at The Takeaway, Melissa Clark, also food writer for the New York Times, who brought some goodies for us. First of all, good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I mean, in my refrigerator, last night I checked before I went to bed so I could talk to you. We have some frozen vegetables in there. We have some uncooked corn tortillas. And we have a lot of cheese, and some of it's a little scary looking. What are the issues for you on leftovers when you go to your refrigerator and decide what's usable and what's not?
Well, I know Melissa would love to get into your refrigerator.
She talks about this all the time.
Yes.
When am I coming over, John?
Deal with John's scary cheese.
I can take care of it.
Yeah. But seriously, you know, when you've got something in the fridge and have to decide whether you can serve it to guests, for instance, or whether it's time to put it in the garbage, these are ethical, moral issues all of a sudden.
They truly are. No, and I'm fascinated by this idea that, you know, the sort of the inherent virtuousness of depleting or dispensing leftovers leads people to just the wackiest ends. People are misbehaving or doing all sorts of outrageous things.
But it's the most virtuous of ideas. We don't want to waste food here, okay? So does that justify you bringing a shopping bag, say, to a party?
Right, exactly. It's a great question. It's the irony. It's the same thing if there's someone who's talking during a movie in a theater. It's the shushers who are always louder than the talkers.
So, Henry, right. let me ask you real quickly. I mean, I'm just thinking about pizza, right?
Yeah.
I love nothing better than cold pizza. It's one of my favorite things in the world.
Oh,
cold pizza,
yeah.
Out of the fridge.
I went to college, too.
But and I still love it. But if somebody brought me a pizza to my house and they brought me two slices of cold pizza out of their fridge, I might go, eh. But if they brought me a whole hot pizza, I'd be thrilled, even though I like cold pizza better.
Precisely. No, it's a kiss and a slap to be served leftovers, because on the one hand, the person is saying, you know, we have this family style relationship and I like you. I feel intimately enough with you that I can give you stuff that's.
So you're better friends, you bring, like, meatloaf to, right?
Exactly, that's been licked.
Strangers,
yes.
Strangers
by the cat.
Steak,
yeah,
all the way. Right. All right, well, what are some stories of people who actually understand this line maybe better than I do?
Well, I have this one story of this law professor in London who every Friday night would rip off the legs from his roast chicken and then put them in pre-addressed envelopes, and on his walk to synagogue Saturday morning, he would mail each of the chicken legs to each of his two daughters who were off at college.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I don't know if ethics actually comes into that. There's a mental illness question.
Right.
Melissa.
Probably some legality too.
It's Melissa. Like a salmonella gram.
So Melissa, you have so much more courage than I do. I have to say, I thought about this long and hard, trying to imagine a scenario where I would have guests over to my house and I would, under any circumstances, serve leftovers, even some delicious leftovers. I could not imagine. I would never do it. Never, ever.
Well, it's all about recreating the leftovers. You want to reincarnate them into something new and delicious. And, you know, you take the old delicious and you turn it into something new and delicious. And, first of all, don't tell them that it's leftovers.
All right, so that's
key. So that's rule number one is, you know, rule number one is don't tell anybody. Rule number two is take something that you've got and make it into something even better. So, for example, what I brought you guys today is a little nibble. That is a Spanish tortilla, and this is actually third generation leftovers. Yes, this is what I did. So I went out to dinner a few days ago to the Standard Grill, fabulous, and I had duck fat fried potatoes. Loved them, didn't finish them. Brought them home, right? So I've got leftovers from dinner out. Then last night I took those leftovers. I chopped up some onions and I got them really golden brown and caramelized.
Yep.
I added the potatoes and then I added some eggs and turned it into a Spanish tortilla.
You made this from it.
Exactly. And that's what we had for dinner last night. And that's what you guys are
then,
having
right?
for
breakfast. It was hot then. It's cold now.
Well, but Spanish tortilla is traditionally served cold at tapas bars. So therefore, it's a perfect leftover.
Wow. So, all right. Melissa Clark, food writer for The New York Times. Henry Alford, you're her colleague. All right.
Yes.
At The Times. She's violated or at least confronted two important rules. One is serving leftovers to guests.
And then telling
number one, but serving restaurant leftovers to guests.
Yeah.
And right. Telling us about it. Telling
and
us that
just,
we've been served
leftovers. Well, you know, we're all friends here. Yeah, we're intimate. Yeah.
But duck fat in the morning, I think that gives her a lot of leeway. Once that's a real form of intimacy.
Well, you know, I did mention at the top that historically, you know, this principle that you've talked about, Melissa Clark, of you take something and make it better. You know, the principle of leftovers is you take what you got, what's left over, and you make it better. I mean, stroganoff is that, right? It's spoiled Russian meat turned into a great sort of side dish.
Yeah, or bubble and squeak or coal cannon or hash, any of these things. No, that there is this great tradition of leftovers. It just, again, as soon as you bring it into the social arena, you open this box of you know, it's sort of Pandora's box as to what's the proper etiquette.
Putting these salmonellagrams aside for a moment, what's the diciest leftover story that you encountered in your article for
the Times? Well, I've got one woman in Portland, Oregon, who had a party to celebrate her marriage, and one of the guests showed up with a mason jar filled with this kind of brown, oozing sludge, and a little note on the mason jar said, "This chocolate zucchini bread was a failed experiment, but perhaps you will like it. Happy marriage."
And she was actually married to the guy she was married to before?
Yeah, still.
No, actually, no. Yeah, no. I'm just imagining that. Oh, that sounds awful.
Doesn't that? Mm. Yeah,
Henry. Can I ask this etiquette and intimacy of leftovers seems not to apply for some reason to barbecue. I've just figured out it was just the 4th of July. I had a barbecue at my house. Had a ton of food left over. The next day, three friends came over. I said, "Come over for a scavenger's barbecue." I called it. We'll cook up the extra food. All they wanted was the stuff that had already been cooked and taken off the plates. They wanted cold chicken, cold sausages. Because it was barbecue, they went right for it.
Yeah,
it seems like it's a little different.
No problem there.
No, and that's actually perfect that happened with barbecue because, of course, soul food. You know, pretty much everything we think of as soul food, the ham hocks and chitlins, that stuff all came out of leftovers. That originally a lot of that stuff was
the history,
stuff that slave owners were giving to their slaves. So you were reenacting history in your backyard.
I knew there was Melissa Clark. Let's take it out on this. It seems as though all the technology in food service, the development of Tupperware, of preservatives, of refrigeration, actually designed to make safe leftovers and extend the life of food, in fact, complicates our lives in this question.
It does complicate it because then you have the question of, it's been in your fridge for how many days? Can I still eat it? What should I do with it? There was a time there when I would go to my mother's house and I would go through her fridge and take things out because I knew she had to finish everything. She had to turn that leftover into some sort of dish. It was in a Tupperware container and I thought, you know, this is borderline. I'm just going to throw it out. So it's made us feel like we have to finish it.
Right.
And you know what? You can throw it out if it's turning bad. Even if it's leftover, throw it out. That cheese, John, out.
Cheese is out. What about the frozen vegetables? Do I puree those and put them in a sauce or throw them out?
If they're still frozen, you can still use them.
Oh, thank you, Melissa. They're sitting in my refrigerator. I'll deal with them when I get home. Henry Alford, food writer for The New York Times. The issue is the thorny question of leftovers in The New York Times. You can read it there. Melissa Clark, of course, our friend, food writer for The Times. Thanks so much for this Spanish tortilla. My breakfast is done.
All right, thanks, John. Vice President Joe Biden expected to make a major healthcare announcement today. And while the country tries to figure it out, we want to know what are other possible solutions.
Hi, my name is Nikki, and I'm from Manhattan, and I am the medical director of homeless services for the Institute for Family Health, and I will see anybody for free at either some soup kitchens or a shelter. So there you go. That's my thing.
Others have found their own remedies. One listener writes to us, "I had a wart that was going to have to be removed with a laser, which cost around $1,500. I had to pay out of pocket for other treatments because my insurance didn't cover them, so I turned to the internet and found a homeopathic treatment using apple cider vinegar, and by golly, it worked. It almost made me want to sit outside of my dermatologist's office and hand out apple cider vinegar to help out."
Insurance doesn't cover apple cider. That's one of the great ironies.
It's cheap, though. It might. If you missed anything, go to the website at thetakeaway.org.
I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.